Macross Speaker Podcast. Excellent.
Yak the Culture, Adrian.
Yak the Culture, Gwen.
And we're here for another episode of
Macross Speaker Podcast on the run.
As listeners might have picked up, recently Adrian's been away on a bit of a road trip to the US, and I'd like to say this is something we don't normally do, but it's now the second time we've done it. So I'll let you explain, Adrian, what is exactly it is we're going to be, people are going to be listening to this episode.
It's a recording of from a panel from the January 2016 Anime Los Angeles. Like the panel that was held at Archon, Macross World Con 2015, it was like the U.S. Renditions panel. Originally, it was supposed to be exactly like the U.S. Renditions panel, but a lot of people ended up falling through that were supposed to be on the panel. They scheduled some other panel to be in its place, but then in the end, Les Claypool III still ended up showing up and presenting a panel more or less about his experience with opening a studio, running the studio, working with U.S. Renditions, and how the studio closed, and how he's still working on anime to this day. But he does talk about some of the same stuff you hear in the previous podcast we uploaded, featuring him and everyone else from U.S. Renditions. But there's a little bit of extra stuff in there, and he talks about the Macross. He talks about Macross Plus, the movie edition, or
I think it was episode 4, mostly. Yeah.
Talks about Macross Plus episode 4 and how he got around the issue of not being given any of the materials to make the recording in itself. So a little bit of review from the previous podcast that we put up, but a little bit new stuff and some more interesting stuff on Macross.
So the audio, since this is recorded from a con, was a little low. It's a little bit unclear at times. I've bumped it up as much as possible. So if this is your thing, give it a listen. I think there's a lot of nuggets of information and some really fun anecdotes, specifically involving Shoji Kawamori. But anyways, here's the audio, so enjoy.
So this was originally going to be a panel with a bunch of us talking about old school anime and how we got it all started way back in the day. And then they canceled, and the thing got canceled, and then it got redone, and it's not even listed half the time. And my wife was going to join me because she writes a lot. She wrote the entire Ghost in the Shell TV series, all the Ghost in the Shell movies. So we were going to do that, but she's got a writing job. So now it's just me. So what I figured I'd do is, you're not just born and you wake up one day and say, I'm going to build recording studios and dub all the biggest titles in anime and they're going to come find me, and this is exactly what's going to happen. And so many things, ridiculous things, had to occur from the time I was a kid until I started working on this. And if you removed a single one of those items, then I wouldn't have worked on Akira and Ghost in the Shell. None of this would have ever happened. I never would have built studio complexes. So I figured, just for some backstory for the first part of this thing, I would just kind of go way back to childhood days and put in place the meeting of certain people and certain events that all ping-pong to the day I got the phone call saying, can you work on our stuff? And what is your stuff? Anime. What's that? but I needed a job, so I said yes. So there's only been three things that I've had a passion for all from birth almost: martial arts, music, and movies. That was it. And if you could have good music in a movie, well, that's two of them are down. And if you had good music in a martial arts movie, well, there you go. You know, Enter the Dragon 24 times in the Chinese. So at a young age, I got into Super 8 filmmaking. And I had a friend, a neighbor, when we were young, and we used to make Super 8 movies all the time. We used to come one reelers, because that's all the money we had, was enough to buy one reel of Super 8 movie film. So the only real story that was important was, what could you fit in one reel of Super 8 film? So we did that, and then I eventually got into other things, and he and I kind of went our separate ways. And then I was a musician with a little garage studio later in life and working regular day jobs like everybody else, you know, bitching about the day job and get home playing music. And I rehooked up with this friend from my childhood, and we decided to make a kung fu movie. We wanted to make a full-on, hour-and-a-half-long kung fu movie in Super 8. So we restart this process, and we're going along, and we're filming this movie, and filming, and he's in the effects industry, so we have access to things like props from Evil Dead 2. Wow, we can't believe this. We can use the cabin from Evil Dead. This is great. I don't know why it's in a kung fu movie, but it's free, so we'll write it in. You know? So as we're working on this thing, we realized that we don't have any Asian people in our kung fu movie. And then we're like, wait a minute, come on, we've got every race on the planet in this movie except Asian people. How can you not have Asian people in a kung fu movie? It doesn't make sense. So my friend said, you know what? I know this guy that works at Rick Baker's makeup effects shop, and his name is Johnny Psycho. And he's a martial artist, and he did this stuff, and he knows some people. And I said, well, if you're going to talk to him, ask him how many Asian people he knows that know how to fight that'll come and be in a movie for free. So he's like, okay. So through Johnny, they show up one day at the dojo where we're filming, and he's got his friend Steve Wang, who's an insanely famous makeup effects artist. I mean, he sculpted the Predator, and he's worked on a million things. And he had made this movie called Kung Fu Rascals. It was just a little short 20-30 minute movie. And he said, oh yeah, I'll be in your movie, you know. And so he was. And we became really good friends, and he wanted to be a filmmaker. So I thought, well, okay, and I never finished my movie. It just, you know, when you get to the last day of filming, and it's not the last day because the movie's done, it's the last day because you're holding the light, and you're pumping the fake blood for the death scene, and you're pulling the trigger on the camera, you realize, I think I've lost my whole crew. This movie is pretty much over. So I ended up helping Steve Wang on some of his movies. And through that, we ended up working on this movie called Kung Fu Rascals, which is a two-hour feature film shot on Super 8. During that process, I get this phone call from somebody, I don't know who the guy is. He said his name was Ken. And he wanted to know if I could do some audio for him on some animation. And I said, well, I can't right now. We've got another month on Kung Fu Rascals. And keep in mind, this is all taking place in a garage. It's a little tiny garage studio. So that was the end of that. I think whatever they were going to do, they went off and did. So I get to the end of working on Kung Fu Rascals, which was insane because it was the director and myself. That was the entire audio post crew in my garage. We never left. Round the clock, 7 days a week. And my pay was simply, he said, I'll pay your bills and feed you for the whole time we're working on the movie. So I was like, well, yeah, that sounds familiar for a lot of people in the movie industry. Unfortunately, when the movie got finished, there was no more money. There was no more food. There was nothing. It wasn't like I was saving money from this process. He was paying my bills and feeding me. As soon as the movie was done, bye. So I'm now unemployed. I call up my old day job that I took a leave of absence from and said, well, can I come back? They said, well, no, because you left. Sales were down, so we can't afford to hire you. It doesn't make sense. We'll hire me and sales will come up. No, we got to get sales back up. If you want to come work for free and get sales back up, then we can start paying you. Wait a minute. I just left the movie industry for this. So I'm getting ready to go to unemployment. I don't even know how to do that. You know, never done it before. So I get up, I'm like, okay, today I go to the unemployment line, and it's a holiday. Wow, I guess I'm not like an unemployment. I'm not even sure where to go, but everything's closed. On that day, as I'm sitting there trying to figure out how I eat tomorrow, I get the phone call from this guy, Ken, again, who said, we're having a horrible time at the studio that we're at. It was called The Cave, because it was a cave It was up on Ventura Boulevard, run by some crazy musicians that knew nothing about audio post and synchronization and video, none of that. And their booth was a dirt cave below the house. So, well, one of the principals that was helping out with the anime stuff that I knew nothing about, he would come home and he would take a shower and the bathtub would be full of dirt and his mom would ask him, where are you working? He was in a recording studio. The bathtub's full of dirt. Where is this studio? In the middle of the desert? And then, so they were desperate. I didn't know any of this, but they were desperate to find a different place. So I said, well, yeah, sure, you can come on over, you know, if you want to make an appointment. And they said, oh, no, we'll meet you now. Well, I kind of works with my schedule because I can't go to the board until tomorrow. So I'm waiting, and doorbell at the garage studio rings, and in walks all these people. Dun, 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 you know, it needed like dun, 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 dun. This line of people walking in my garage studio, and it was Kevin Seymour, Bob Napton, Yutaka Maseba, Ken Iodomi, who for the first couple of years I knew him. I thought his name was Kenny Adomi, but his name is Ken Iodomi. So I called him Kenny for years. So they all these people walk in, and Ray Garcia, and they walk in and they start asking me questions because, you know, they're obviously having a horrible experience. I think I was telling Jeff at one point, to get to the cave, it was on a hillside on Ventura Boulevard. Well, they had no equipment. No video decks, no synchronizers, none of the stuff necessary to do this kind of work. So Ken and Yutaka and Kevin and all those guys had to carry it every session up all these long stairs and then down into this dirt studio. And so when they walked in my place, I had just finished, you know, months of Kung Fu Rascals, which was shot silent. So everything you hear, we did in a garage. All the dialogue, everything. So they walk in, they're looking around, they're like, wow, is this what a real studio looks like? And I'm thinking, well, not really. You guys, but anything would look good after the cave, I'm guessing. You know? That's the thing. Back in those days, that whole beginning era, L.A. Hero, U.S. Renditions, all of that, they knew nothing about dubbing or audio. And neither did I, for the most part. We were totally flying blind. So it was really easy to impress them with just, you know, a couple of cables where they belong to impress them. So they came in, and they're just grilling me. Well, do you have track sheets? And do you have this? Do you have that? And how many microphones do you have? Uh-oh. This interview was going so well until I got asked, how many microphones do you have? This is actually the microphone from back then. Steve Wang bought it for me so that I could do Kung Fu Rascals. So, I mean, it's a nice mic, it's a grand, but this is the only one. And this is actually still, it's the original. And so I'm thinking, oh my God, I almost have a job, but if I don't answer this question right, I'm doomed. I'm back in unemployment tomorrow. So I asked him, well, why? How many microphones do you need? Well, we bring all the actors in. All day long, they just stand there and they come up and they're, you know, we give them multiple microphones and sometimes they only have one line for a whole day. And how do they like that? How do you like that? How do you like somebody standing there for 8 hours that has two little lines? And so, you know, my poverty-stricken self said, why don't you record them one at a time? We can do that? Yes. Oh man, we could save a fortune. We wouldn't have to pay people that only got one line. They could just come in with it. Yes, I am your savior. Feel free to write a check. We get through all of this, and then they just leave. And they said, "Well, we have to discuss it amongst ourselves, and we'll think about it." And yada yada yada. So there I am thinking, oh, okay, tomorrow is unemployment time. Wasn't 3 minutes later, my phone rang. Well, we've talked it over. We've decided to go with you, and we'd like to start immediately. And my first question is, where are you? And, oh, we're around the corner. We're ready to get on the freeway. Well, at that time, where I live, the freeway was walking distance from the house. I thought, hey, the decision real damn quick. We want to start immediately. Okay. And then Ken gets on the phone, and in true apologetic Japanese, traditional Japanese businessman fashion, apologizes profusely for the fact that he can only pay me $550 a day. And of course, the crappy day job that wanted me to come back, work for free, build up sales, and then they put me back on salary, was paying me $500 a week for a two-hour drive each way. So, maintaining my best studio salesman philosophy. I really want to help you guys. I think we can start off at that rate. I think we'll be fine. We'll just see how it all works out. But, we'll get you out of this crisis and all that. And then I hang up the phone, and I guarantee you, I did the money dance. Like,
I'm glad this group is sound from you. I can't believe this.
And that weird, make super 8 movies, meet a guy who knows a guy who introduces me to a guy, blah, blah. That's what led to working on anime. I didn't even, other than Gigantor and Speed Racer when I was a kid, which, nobody said the word anime. Nobody knew. You didn't even know it was Japanese to begin with, It was kind of like, the animation isn't as smooth, but the stories and the stuff are cool. I mean, come on, that's a giant robot smashing stuff. Yeah. Disney ain't doing that, And then, I knew nothing. I just knew I wanted to do a good job. If you're going to pay me, one day what I used to make in a week, I've got to do the best job I can. And then I started watching this stuff, and I'm like, wait a minute, these are guys who they turn into solenoids, and they're cutting people apart, there's violence in schools. This is hip. I want to work on this stuff. And that's what we did. All the early day stuff was all done in my garage, with just me. Me and a crew of crazy people, none of which knew what the heck we were doing. And if you go back and listen to some of those early Vargas and Guyvers and Macross 2, it kind of hurt my spinal cord. This is some of what we did back then, but we're learning. And we were there in the garage for a few years until we started getting busier. And this is the original tape deck from back in those days, the original controller, the original microphone. I probably have a ton of other things hiding around here. From that, it just slowly grew. I ended up having to move into a real facility, start building studios. Then I outgrew that and had to get two more locations. So, at the height of our madness, we were doing three studio facilities worth of anime all at once. And he spoke of some of the crazy titles. Some of the adventures, you never hear about the crazy stuff from the actors because they're talking about what they do. Everybody goes to actor panels and the actors are like, I show up, they tell me what to say, I try to give it my all. What are the nutcases that are there, at midnight still trying to work on this stuff? And I'm totally winging this whole panel, so if I freeze up every once in a while, it's like, what else can we do? My brain is thinking. I got some questions for me.
Tell us some of the actors that came through in those early days of the garage and eventually to the studio.
Well, in the... Thank you, sir.
My engineer is young, Mark. What's going on?
I'm sure you guys are familiar with Steve Bloom, who is like a voiceover god for anime. But he wasn't even a voiceover artist when he was in my garage. We had to constantly tell him he was great, he should do this for a living. And he had, he was working for Charlie Band Productions and working on, horror films and all that. And so he would come in and we just knew he was, if he put his mind to it, he was gone. He was destined for greatness. And we found this out on Giant Robo, because Giant Robo was so secretive and so insane that they wouldn't tell us anything about the story arc, where it was headed, what characters were going to get introduced. We're like, what are you guys doing? You're supposed to give us... No. really? You're not going to tell us anything. Nope. So we cast Steve Bloom as multiple roles because he can do that flawlessly. Well, what they didn't tell us was that the whole second half of the show is Steve Bloom talking to himself.
Which he can do.
Yeah, he does, but that's when we knew, okay, dude, look, we're all stuck here. You're going somewhere because you're out of control. And we didn't know that, though, but that's how we found out how versatile he was how many voices he could do, and nothing will hammer that home better than, okay, for the next 8 minutes, there's Steve Bloom and Steve Bloom, and they're having a conversation, and they're arguing, and they're wow. So, in the early days, it was Jonathan Fahn, Tom Fahn, Melissa Fahn, Dorothy Fahn. You can tell it's a family affair. Steve Castling. So you have to be really old for some of these names to mean anything to you, because they were the ones that were in everything that we did back in the early days. And Steve Castling, I don't even know if he does this anymore, but we were doing Orgus back in the garage days, and this is my greatest Steve Castling story. This is a man that had his own private little plane that he built himself and lived in Big Bear and would fly and land and get his little funky car and drive to the studio. My garage studio was in Pacoima. And, he'd fly in and then get back in his little plane and fly home. Wow! For this money? Wait a minute. He comes in one day, and Ray Garcia is directing an episode of Orgus. And Steve Castling comes in, and he's supposed to do a death screen. Planes, ship's coming in, gets hit, it's going down in flames. What they need out of him is a death screen. So Steve, being an actor, says, what exactly is going on here? I know I need to yell, but what's happening right now in this scene? Ray Garcia goes on to explain everything about Orgus that you would ever want or not want to know, all the way back to the beginnings. He was a walking encyclopedia of Orgus. And my garage studio didn't have a window, so I couldn't see what was going on. We just heard it in the control room. So we're sitting there. Of course we're laughing. This is ridiculous. At the end of all of this, all Steve Castling says, I don't think I really need all that for a death screen. That was the end of his comment, and he did scream, and that was it. That's what he came in and did. But some of the other people back in the early days, Bryan Cranston used to come by. Whether or not they can admit this because of SAG rules is, I won't name what shows they're in to protect everybody. But Bryan Cranston used to come by. David Hayter, who wrote the first X-Men movie, and then, of course, is... Exactly. So he would come by, and back in those days I was doing pretty decently financially, and that most of the actors weren't. And so I always had a spread: bagels, fresh ground coffee, snacks, sodas, whatever, just all here, help yourself. And there'd be times when people that are famous now would come in and really? You're going for 3 bagels today, are you? Man, I've had breakfast, I might not even get lunch. I'm not working much these days, are you? My wife chased Bryan Cranston out of her office twice for snooping on her computer. He'd just walk around, he'd be bored, waiting to come in. He's like, oh, over here. My wife, I'm like, what are you doing? Get the hell out of this room. And, he didn't know that years later, Breaking Bad and every other thing that he was going to do. Mike
was giving us some Power Rangers.
Yeah, exactly. And Mike Forrest, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he was Apollo in the original Star Trek series. One of my favorite episodes, he grows real big. He's Who Lord? Exactly, Who Lord for Adonis. And that was one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. So, of course, when Mike Forrest comes in, it's like... And of course, it's the same old thing that we all do. Just, some people do that to me because of what I've done over the years. I still do it to other people, that impress me. And you're like, you're Mike Forrest. Yes, I am. I feel like he wouldn't know. That's another one that used to come in, and he was the world's biggest cornet fiend. you couldn't feed Mike Forrest enough corn nuts. And here's the kind of stuff that used to go on every day that nobody ever writes about, talks about, or, you know, the actors don't talk about this stuff. He was such a corn nut fiend that one day he was coming to do a session, I think it was on Gundam, it was definitely one of the Gundams or the Orgasmo 2 series that we did. And I knew he was coming, so I went and got a whole bunch of corn nuts, and I taped them all around the television screen that was just outside the booth. So he gets in the booth, and he's starting to work, and he's doing his lines, and then you're, hey, wait a minute, what's that around the TV screen? He stops the session. Hey, that's it, we're done. He comes out of the booth, walks up to the TV, and he's sitting there like some ridiculous W.C. Fields routine, peeling the tape off each packet and putting them down until he's got this whole stack of corn nuts, and he goes back to the booth. Oh, what's this little teeth? He really just stopped the session for corn nuts. Apollo from Star Trek stopped the session for corn nuts. So those are regular, just the plain old. He definitely had the barbecue and the ranch or something else back then. But he was a purist, man. And so much of Apollo, he wants them to regular. Plain and simple. But yeah, the fact that a recording session needed to stop in order for Apollo to get the corn nuts on that's kind of when you look at what you do for a living and go, you can't make this stuff up. This is ridiculous. I would fall flat on it. He probably knows more of the actors that we work with than I do, because it's at one point I have another facility where I did all the mixing. So I didn't even see half the time. I would just, you know, materials, I'd come get materials and go mix. You had a...
Yeah, were you doing any Foley work also, or was this all just mixing?
We would... Yeah, funny you should ask. There was the garage studio where I actually was rigged up to do Foley because we were doing, you know, Super 8 features. Then we got to the first studio, and I didn't have a booth, but my landlord had this 4x4 acoustic systems booth. The damn thing weighs thousands of pounds. Each wall weighs 750 pounds. But it's only 4 foot by 4 foot, right? Lovingly labeled the refrigerator by all the actors that had to spend hours in that stupid thing. But we would actually try to pick up little, you know, things that were missed, because one of the things about how we worked back in those days was with complete respect for the Japanese crews. And the reason for that is because we were directly tied to them through Ken Iodomi and some of the people on staff. So at no point in time were we an American company that said, screw Japan, we'll do whatever the hell we want with these things. It was always, we can't quite make out what's going on here. Okay, we'll just call Japan and talk to the writer. And they appreciated that because they thought, wow, these guys are actually, they care. And the producers over there, it was all money. They care not so much. But all of the artists working on it and the sound people and the writers, they cared far more than they were being paid for. So when it came to like additional sound effects and things that we were going to do, we always looked at it as their work isn't shoddy, let's cover it with a bunch of American over-the-top stuff. We would look at it as, those poor guys cut this in a day. What can we do to help them out and make it even better? And my whole career, that's what we did. When I did Akira, I had to write a letter to the Akira committee laying out exactly what I was going to do to their baby. Because, you know, it's Akira. It's, you know, damn near a national treasure. So at that point, I had already been doing this for 8 or 9 years, so they knew if I said what I was going to do, I was being honest, and I was going to have total respect for their products. So to quickly answer your question, yeah, we would do little pickup things, but it ended up being in that stupid 4-foot by 4-foot booth, so, you know, it's not a whole lot you can do in this little space. And my landlord had acquired that booth from, now listen to this carefully, you'll be tested, from the Financial News Network when they went out of business. All I could think of when I heard that was, I wonder how many people invested using their advice. And we had their couches and their booth and all that stuff. Like, really? The Financial News Network? Yeah, it says it right on the back of the book. And we're paying them. Wow! They didn't invest. So, yeah, that's exactly, you know, his Foley question, which I'm glad you guys are asking stuff, because, you know, I'll just, my brain will lock up. It's been, you know, it's 25 years of doing this, a billion tails. That sends me off into directions. When we did Akira, it was a really noisy four-track mix from the 80s. That's what was, matter of fact, I wish I, it's back there somewhere. I have the track sheets, the Akira track sheets that they sent with the materials they sent me, which is kind of mind-blowing, you know, I should hang out with that. So I wrote this letter explaining what we're going to do, and what we ended up doing to Akira was anything that impacted anything. I don't care what it was, a motorcycle, hitting something, a punch, a kick, explosion, whatever. All of that was doubled. Every single thing in that movie got doubled. And because it was four-track stereo, that means there was no stereo behind you. The surround speakers were mono. So, we can't have that. This is a brand new 5.1 release, theatrical and home video. So, I hired a friend of mine, Lisa Hannon, she's just a background cutting fiend. That's what she does for a living, is cuts background sounds for movies. So we layered in all new matching backgrounds in the front in stereo and in the back in stereo. And then Ted Hall, the mixer I was working with at DOP Sound, he was just amazing. This guy was off the charts dedicated to it didn't matter. It didn't matter what walked in the door. He was dedicated to sound. So they had just spent some hideous amount of money at POP Sound on this digital machine to clean up noise. And it was a real-time process, except it had a huge, huge latency. I mean, it would come out the other end, you'd be recording your movies like 19 frames out of sync or something. So we cleaned all of that up. And then he went in and we spread out their original mix to give it a little more width and depth. And I had also layered in subwoofer, dedicated subwoofer to the whole movie. And he had this cool trick where he had subwoofer on a fader. And anytime anything blew up, he'd just slide the fader up and pull it back down. So we got through that whole process, not without numerous arguments with the producers, the American producers, Japan loved us. But the weirdest audio review I've ever gotten in decades of doing this was some reviewer went to a theater, saw Akira, and said, "It has the best use of silence that I've ever heard." What? Come on. All that work we did, we still miss on that thing. The review is, "It has the best use of silence that you've ever heard." And what that was, if you're familiar with the movie, there's a scene where they're kind of floating, I think, on like big giant chunks of concrete or something, and it's this real surreal thing. And obviously, originally, they wanted that silent, because what they shipped us was silence with a bunch of noise. You know, optical noise, mag noise, analog noise, console noise, you name it. So, you know, you'd see it on the meters, like, that's your silence. A lot of ruckus. So I look at Ted Hall, the mixer, and I said, "I got an idea here. Let's mess with people." I said, "Why don't we pull your entire facility down into digital black?" So he looked at me like, "Really? You want to do that, huh?" Well, the director wanted silence here. I suggest, for the first time, technology is now available. Let's do it. So he looked at me kind of like, "Okay, we're going to hear about this. I just know it." We made multiple passes, and he's sitting there pulling this huge console of faders down, banks at a time, turning off auxiliary synths, doing off mutes. I mean, it took forever, right? To get silence. And so we did it, and we went to the premiere in a theater, and I remember we're all watching it, and we're sitting there like, "Who cares?" He popcorn. It got to that scene, and it's what we call digital black. There is no, it's a complete absence of noise. And the whole audience went, and everybody's like putting their stuff down. And I'm looking at the audience, but I'm not sure if this is a good thing or not. I just freaked out the whole thing. And afterwards, people were like, I didn't know what to do. There's nothing to do. Just watch the movie. So that's probably like the penultimate review of my entire audio career of decades of work. It's the best use of silence we've ever heard. About doing that? Oh, hell no. I should be, but my career is such that I was always kind of like leading the people that hired me. I'm not like, you know, there's no backpacking going on here. It's just somehow I got involved with people that had less experience with this stuff than I did. So I used to like be crazy and get away with anything I wanted for the most part. I mean, every once in a while, you know, producer would go, that's true. That's that. No. You got to pull that back. You can't have 9 different effects processors on the Demon and Bastard. You know, we did that series. Really? Why not? You understand what they say? Yeah. Well, but, you know, years later, you can't understand a damn thing Bane says, but they're worried about my processor. And then, like that. Oh, this one?
Yeah, that goes
close. Yeah, that's it. I gotta take a break. There's a couple of good stories here. These are gems. So, 2 things with Macross Plus. I don't know how familiar. I know there's a couple of people here familiar with Macross Plus. Some of them named conventions after that show. But we were doing, first we did Macross 2, and then, you know, we got on our big boy pants and we were doing Macross Plus. And by that time, I had a pretty good handle on what it was I did, editing, mixing, all that stuff. I've been doing it for a long time. So we get 3 episodes of Macross Plus finished, and the 4th one comes in. Well, Manga decided that would be a fine time to get into a rights battle over money and everything else with Japan. Only got 1 show left, dude. You couldn't wait it, you know, another few weeks. So Japan, and nobody knows this because it was all hush hush, and what are they going to do? Sue me now? It's like, so it goes, you can't tell that story. We get Macross Plus number 4. It's the end of the series. We're going to wrap it all up. Got the audio? No. We cannot contractually use the audio from Japan. Okay, I'm guessing there's an intelligent suggestion that's about to follow. Oh, I was wrong. The suggestion was, well, just pull stuff from 1 through 3. Did you say that out loud before you said it to me? Because if I just pull stuff from episodes 1 through 3, there's music tied. So when the guy sets his water down, you'll hear the water hit the table with a piece of the music. So I finally told him, look, you can't. There's no way to make this happen. So in typical fashion, how cheaply can you recreate the other movie? It's Macross. You understand how popular this is, and I will be killed if I mess this up. Can you put your name on it if I do this? Not mine. So it comes down to, we recreated Macross Plus number 4 from scratch. We started with silence, absolute zero. So, and that was, this gets better. That was after we had already done it once with the original M&E tracks from Japan. But, wait a minute, and we can't use the original dialogue either because it's now a rights issue. Okay, so it's going to be silent, and there's no dialogue. Yeah, we have to re-record all the dialogue. Well, can we just use the script? It's already written. Everybody liked it. No, I think you have to rewrite it. Does it count if we just copy the whole script and save it yet? I mean, what, change a word here or there? What's the rules here? I don't know how many lawyers are going to come investigate us for Macross Plus 4. So we did this, hired a friend of mine, Mark Allen, to cut effects, and we did Foley. We did everything, and I won't legally get into how I was able to resurrect the music, except for 2 cues. But we redid the whole thing. And it came and went. Well, I didn't know at the time that Shoji Kawamori was going to be coming by the studio for some other project that they were doing, and I was going to have to show a Macross Plus episode for that he's never heard, that he's the creator and director and everything else of. So that was a moment. Well, prior to him actually coming to America, my wife Mary was flown to Japan for research to write the original Ghost in the Shell movie. So she's there, she's hanging out with all the directors, all the sound team, and the writers, and doing all the research. Well, it's Japan, so it doesn't matter what you do during the day. At night, you're going to drink and eat, and that's just what has to happen. So she managed to find that laser disc in Japan and buy it for me. Well, while they're out on a Ghost in the Shell drinking binge, that thing falls behind the booth in this restaurant. And when she tells that to Ken Iodomi, who then tells it to everybody else, it turned into a panic, just an amazing panic of very important people getting up, stop eating, while the restaurant people are tearing the booth apart, ripping the chairs out, and they finally scrounge that up. And then they all start laughing. Of course, I didn't get to go. You know, she gets to go to Japan. I always work on this. Then they start finding all kinds of other stuff behind this booth, and you know, the typical Japanese fashion, everything begins with, and then they're just pulling out all kinds of valuable stuff, like, good thing my disc fell back there, because, oh, look, $20 bill, what is all this junk? So she brings that back for me, and the reason that it's signed to me, and has a mecha drawing on it from Macross Plus, is because Shoji Kawamori came to the studio, and I played Macross Plus number 4 for him while my stomach turned into a pit of acid sitting next to him. Or actually, I couldn't even see him. I was sitting in the control panels, and he was up on an elevated couch listening. And after it was all over, I'm like, I'm afraid to turn around, man. With no input from the creator, we recut his entire movies or show sound. And I turn around and look at him, and he's got this big old grin on his face, and all he says is, "Oh, Hollywood style." That's it. It was like a long, intense conversation on how to post his movie. So, in order to embarrass my daughter, which I will do.
No, I'm going to beat that.
No, it's going to be real short and sweet. To show you that these gods of anime, you know, that everybody looks up to, they're people. They're, you know, they work on the stuff, they go home, they have lives, and they just try to do the best job they can. Well, when he was in the studio for this, he was missing his family and his daughter. So at one point, Shoji Kawamori is on all fours, crawling around in our commons area underneath a pool table, playing with her. Because he misses his dog. And that's another one of those moments Mary tells me, there's no way you cannot make this stuff up. And I've learned that from working with so many people over the years that once work is aside, everybody, they're just people. You know? I spent a lot of time with Kevin Seymour, and you know, people are, Kevin Seymour is like the founder of so many of these things. And yeah, he definitely was. Without him, a lot of this wouldn't exist. And he and I spent many, 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 many hours sitting in the control room, scratching our heads, going, "I'm not sure what we got ourselves into here." It's like, well, and anybody that knows anything about Kevin Seymour, or knows of him at least, his contribution to anime cannot be understated. He was there way, way before I ever showed up. And he was bringing this stuff to America, books, videos, anything he could do. And he would even do he and his buddies would do the original artwork, because they couldn't get anything from Japan. So they were flying completely solo. But he was a maniac. Once he had his teeth into something, he was good at that. And everybody thought, he's the weirdest dude I've ever met. He's just the weirdest guy. The thing was, he was the weirdest guy I ever met. But the thing, he was weird on so many levels and topics that he would eventually find why you're weird. And he had a whole section of his collection devoted to whatever that was somehow magically. And things would start, he'd find out what I like, you know, like, well, that's kind of weird, that's offbeat. Then things start showing up from his house and his collection. You're weird on every level of humanity, you know, because it doesn't matter what anybody's into, you've got like 100 of them, you know? So one of the things he sunk his teeth into was we started doing those shows, you know, in space, people are in helmets. I'm like, well, what? You know, when we first started, we didn't do anything. It's like, I don't know, the band didn't do anything. It was just like a regular full voice. They're not, they don't sound like they're in a helmet. I started thinking, no, we got to come up with something. So my garage studio was in my mom's house. I rented the garage from her, gave her a little spare change, and she didn't have any use for a garage anyway. So I went into the house, I think it was during, might have been during Macross 2, you know, you probably know better than me. And I thought, I gotta find something that sounds like a great helmet. I stole one of the Tupperware containers. This is it. This is the Tupperware container that I still haven't given back to my mom in 25, whatever years, you know, 1991 or whatever. And all you would do is just put it next to the microphone, and now I'm in a helmet. And Kevin, like, aren't you afraid to record something already processed like that? No, is that the sound you want to hear? Yeah, well, then we're not. Don't worry about it.
Will you get Brian Cranston?
Probably. If he was in Macross, there's Brian Cranston. I'll be in Breaking Bad someday and in Saving Private Ryan. There's a whole host of other movies. But right now, I'm wondering when the last time this thing was washed. And who's in the booth before me? So I show this to Kevin. And Kevin being Kevin, I now have a collection of things like this. And he's like, well, that one doesn't sound quite right. So, and I've got hard hats with holes cut in them. And this one's got two holes. That one's got six holes. And then little Tupperware, big Tupperware. What is all this crap? Well, it's got to sound like what I see. You just took that old Tupperware and ran with it into their Skippy. And to this day, I still have a box of medical masks from the Blackjack series, because it was a medical series, and I got a dust mask, you know, Home Depot. Two cents, be a little muffly, it's only a dust mask. Dude, that's not a medical mask, that's a dust mask. I'm positive nobody's going to figure that out, Kevin. Nope. Next day, he went to a medical supply house and came back with cases of medical masks that I still have, and he wrote on one of them, I think he talked on the Sable directing the Blackjack stuff, and I have a box that says, to Yutaka from Blackjack, and it's Kevin's writing. I look at that and go, I should throw that away. No, that's actually kind of cool. I should get out of there. So I don't know how much time we have before I get booted out of here, because I don't know if anybody's got any questions, but I also have another audio demo we can fly through real quick over there.
You guys want to see a 3D Street Fighter 2?
Yeah.
Question, at the time of doing Macross Plus, was there any discussion about bringing Macross 7 over as well?
Good Lord, I don't even know what I had for breakfast. I know there was talk about the Macross movie, and we got all excited about the Macross movie back then, and then it ended up being, we're just going to take the show and cut it together and add a couple scenes, and it's got nothing to do with you guys, and we thought, well, that movie's going to suck then. You don't get to get paid more on it. But, yeah, I was never privy to what was maybe coming or negotiations. I would just, it would just fall in my lap when it either A, went through, or B, all went to hell. Like on Macross 4, you know. Yeah, exactly. Ken usually handled that when he wasn't buying us pizzas covered in jalapenos. And Ken would never ask you what you wanted on the pizza. He would treat us every day to pizzas from Domino's that were covered in jalapenos. Ken, no jalapenos, please. Just take off. Ken, me babbling like this to Ken would have driven him insane. Because I don't think Ken ever had an answer that was more than five words long. Yeah, it didn't matter what you asked him. You know, if you asked him to explain the theory of relativity, complicated, don't like it. That's how everything was with Ken. And, you know, I ran into him like a year ago or so, and you gotta remember, you know, we started this stuff in the end of 91, beginning of 92. And he sounded the same. It's like, Ken, it doesn't matter how long you're in America, everything is three, four words with a heavy accent. How does that work? So, if nobody.
So,
both
as a audio engineer, what would you make more from transmission to
music? After I started hiring people, I was not the guy in the control room tracking the dialogue. I was the guy editing the dialogue, I was the guy mixing the shows, and I was the guy supervising, you know, 10 different shows at once. But the biggest complaint towards translators would be, here's what people don't understand about this, and I'll try to get it through. The translation should be as accurate as possible to what the content coming from Japan was. That's the whole point of you're not worried about idiomatic translation. You want the translation of what Japan was trying to convey so that you don't piss off everybody over there when you get free with words. Then the writers, like what my wife does when she localizes it, is now I know what the translation says. If it's a good translation, it's accurate. Now I know what they were shooting for, now I know what I can deviate and go to. And if the point of a line was to get the audience to laugh, and American audiences are not going to laugh because it's a completely idiomatic Japanese joke that most people won't get unless they research it, well, then the job of the American scriptwriter is make the audience laugh, because that's what they were looking for in Japan. They were looking for humor in that line. So now the American writer can look at that and go, okay, here's the accurate translation. Will that fly for a Western audience, yes or no? And does it fly within the confines of how the story is developing on the American side? And then they write, you know, what they think is appropriate. So people that care, that's all I ever wanted to work with material-wise, was translators that cared and tried to get it right, and then didn't get angry when their hard work got changed for localization, because it's called localization for a reason. And then if the American writers care and they're trying to get really good sync, they're trying to be witty, they're trying to, you know, and they're trying to propel the story, maybe not with the same words, not the same joke, but you're going to get from point A to point B with the same knowledge when you get to the end of it. So as far as translators, you know, the only things I would ever piss and moan about were when people just didn't work up to their abilities, you know, or to the best that they could. Well, it was just a paycheck. That used to drive me crazy, you know. Well, I'm only getting X amount of bucks, so bang, you know.
For Ghost in the Shell, can you talk about how you approach the different characters that were, like, basically speaking but moving their mouths, they're communicating through, like, communications or, like, AIs talking to robots, and how you made that, you know, kind of work that?
In the original movie?
Yes.
That was one of those where you get to disrespect Japan a little bit. Because we had a thing we called processing roulette. And we would analyze scenes, and we'd go, there's no consistency in what we just heard. Oh, it was processing roulette. Well, he's speaking mind link right now, so we use this process, and then we're going to go to these others for this and that. Oh, he's doing mind link again. What was that we used? I don't know. Just put this one. Oh, you guys are doing processing roulette. On that movie, Kevin Seymour and I spent 2 8-hour days watching that whole movie for 16 hours, analyzing every single mind link, communication line, radio line, every single one. Of course, we also got paid for that 16 hours. And the studio got paid for those 16 hours. But there was no way we were going to play processing roulette on that movie. So we analyzed that whole thing. And, you know, obviously, if you listen to Japanese mix and you listen to our mix, hopefully, I'm not going to say better, I'm just going to say consistent. You know, this is coming through a radio, but it's a mind link. So it's a mind link process coming through a radio speaker. So it wouldn't sound like a mind link from person to person. It would sound like a mind link into a radio speaker coming out of the car. So there was, and, but that's Kevin. I just went along with those rides because there's no stopping him, man. yeah, if there's no more, we'll do a quickie before we get moving. And just to let you know, in 2015, I only did two projects, and I really don't do this stuff anymore. I did the complete restoration of Castle of Cagliostro, which people seem to get a hold of me. I can't read that. Oh, thanks. We'll get over that quick. Somehow I managed to have all the original materials from decades ago, and nobody else does. And so when they call me and say, could you make this mix sound a little better? I'm pretty sure I can. I got all the original elements.
Thank you guys for coming out.
All right, that brings us to the end of another episode. As always, you can contact us at speakerpod@gmail.com or on the Macross Fans US Facebook group or on any number of other social media pages. Look us up on Twitter as well. So until next episode, when we will no doubt be talking a lot about Macross Delta, this is the Speaker Podcast, folding out.
You owe me 11 lunches.
Man, there is just no pleasing you. Ha 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 ha